You're listening to Back to the Light with J.D. Rieger. Spiritual Necessity. Hey, everybody. Welcome to yet another episode of Back to the Light. I am J.D. Rieger, and I don't know about you and the listening audience, but I'm carrying a lot of worry this week for the escalating COVID numbers every time I leave the house, for the shows I've booked this summer and fall, should I even be doing them, and just a bunch of personal stuff that I probably shouldn't get into. But one thing that keeps me cautiously moving forward is all the love I've been feeling for this project lately. So I wanted to say from the bottom of my heart, thank you for listening to and sharing the podcast and music stuff. Every little bit of it helps uplift and keep me going, despite the worry, despite the anxiety, and despite myself. My guest this week is the songwriter and musician Hannah Sandoz. Hannah's new EP, To Love and Loss, comes out August 15th at hannahsandoz.bandcamp.com. That's hannahsandoz.bandcamp.com. It's a really cool record, and we're going to hear two tracks from it later on in the show. But first, here's my conversation with Hannah Sandoz. Hannah, thanks for joining me on the show.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
I know you have a new record coming out soon, but before we get into that, I kind of wanted to ask you a little bit about your backstory.
Sure.
And primary interest there is because we are both from the South.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a big one. Which state are you from?
I am from Memphis, Tennessee.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm from Lafayette, Louisiana. Those are two different parts of the South, but they're both there.
But culturally not dissimilar. Memphis is much more in line with Mississippi and Louisiana, Alabama than it is with the rest of Tennessee, which is very Appalachian.
Yeah, I agree. And I would say that the musical influences of Memphis are a lot more akin to like the Mississippi Delta region than, you know, like the rest of Appalachia. I wouldn't say that like Delta Blues or Zydeco in my case has a whole lot of influence on the kinds of music I make as an artist, but I would say that it's definitely influenced the kind of music I like to listen to as an artist. So I really swing towards a lot of like chromatic music, music with accordions, and I think that Zydeco and Delta Blues might have a little bit to do with that.
How could it not?
Right, exactly.
So how long did you live down there?
So I was born in South Louisiana. I lived there for 5 years. I moved to Oxford, Mississippi with my mom while she was finishing up grad school at Ole Miss. And then I moved back to Louisiana when I was 10. I lived in Metairie for a year. That was shortly after Katrina. That was pretty crazy. And then from ages 10 to 17, I was back in my hometown, Lafayette, Louisiana.
Did you get involved in the music scene at all down there?
Yeah, I did. I actually started playing guitar and writing songs when I was in high school, around like 14. And I would play at open mics, just about anywhere I could find one. I played at a couple of restaurants. It's kind of difficult when, you know, you're in high school and you're a musician, because finding places that will allow minors to play that aren't solely audiences composed of minors was pretty difficult because of like bars and laws like that. But there's actually this really interesting law called the Roddy Romero Law that allows underage kids to play in bars with the bartender's consent, as long as they show up at the beginning of their set and leave before the end of the, or and leave right at the end of their set. And that actually led to me getting my first ever paid gig when I was probably like 16.
That's cool that they have a law like that on the books.
It is pretty interesting. It's because Roddy Romero, I believe, was this like young guitarist in some Cajun band that I'm forgetting the name of. If anyone from back home listens to this, they'll crucify me probably for not remembering it. But yeah, it was pretty interesting. I was very fortunate to be able to engage in those spaces.
You know, I was lucky. I got started when I was 14 also, but I was playing in my dad's band, so he was able to sneak me in.
That rocks. Yeah, I could have lied about my age, probably. Like, there weren't many bartenders who were, like, trying to ID me when I rolled up with my gear, but I'm a pretty bad liar and just generally kind of an honest person, so I never would have gotten away with it.
Well, that's a good thing.
Thank you. Yeah, I try. I do.
What made you decide to leave Louisiana?
Yeah, I kind of felt when I was graduating that I hadn't seen much of the world. It's a little bit hard, you know, like you really have to have a car to leave the state unless you want to take the train or the bus. And well, asking my mom to like take the train or the bus to some random place for like a weekend by myself in high school was like out of the cards. So I guess I just really, really, really wanted to travel. I wanted to see other parts of the United States. I wanted to eventually go on to see other countries. And I landed in Oberlin, Ohio, which is like a small, small town, much smaller than the town I grew up in, which felt like a small town, but wasn't compared to Oberlin. And it was a really interesting comparison to where I grew up because it's this very small town in the middle of rural Ohio. I would say there's like probably a good 10-mile radius before you hit another like town, proper town. But it's got this like little bubble of like leftist ideology and very liberal progressive thinking because of the liberal arts college that was founded there hundreds of years ago, and the conservatory that was founded there hundreds of years ago. So it was a really comforting place and a very safe place for me to focus on my art and focus on my music without like all of the pressures of like living in a big city for the first time.
Sure. And so you moved there to go to Oberlin College or the conservatory, or is that the same thing?
17. I graduated from high school, Lafayette High School, and I decided to matriculate to the Oberlin Conservatory of Music. I actually attended the college as well for a short time. I was seeking out a Bachelor of Arts and a Bachelor of Music. But after a while, I realized how much more expensive it would be if I stayed for the fifth year to complete my second degree. And I ended up dropping it and actually just keeping the music degree.
And what was your field of study of music or your instrument specialty, maybe?
Totally. Field of study is a good question. I have a Bachelor of Music and Technology in Music and Related Arts. So it's a bit of a mouthful. We call it TIMARA, kind of like tomorrow. It's a bit of a pun because at the time that it was founded, there were very few programs that were equally focused on recording engineering and like contemporary classical music. And the Tomorrow program at Oberlin was very focused on the intersection between those two and still is to this day.
That sounds very interesting. And I've talked to a few other people with classical backgrounds, but who also play in what I guess is pop music. And I'm curious for your take on what the intersection of the two is and how maybe your higher range of knowledge applies to pop music.
Yeah. So, I mean, we always had this running joke, me and my colleagues throughout college, we'd be like, I'd be like, hey, can I play you this thing I'm working on? And then someone would be like, oh man, that was a really great song. And then someone would be like, you mean peace? It was a really great piece. And it's kind of just poking fun at this idea of like, you know, where do we draw the line between a song and a piece? What makes a piece of classical music with lyrics and poetry an art song as opposed to just a song? Where do you draw the line between an art song and a folk song? And my opinion and the opinion of many of my colleagues in the Tomorrow program is that that line is completely arbitrary. You know, it's a line drawn by exclusionists, by people who want to create a sense of the in and the other, and that anything can be art and that nothing is more art than anything else. So a lot of what I would describe as classical knowledge that I learned at Oberlin is like the idea of 12-tone equal temperament and the way that tones and harmonies are organized within 12-tone equal temperament. But that organization of pitches actually only reflects the harmonies and tone organizations used by like Western European classical music et al. So, like, there's a very, very, very small portion of the history of music that my education is relevant to, yet the classical music world focuses on 12-tone equal temperament and on Western European classical music as, like, the pinnacle of music and sound. So a lot of, I would say, the most important knowledge that I got at Oberlin was this idea of decentering classical music and pop music and Western music as all of these ideas that exist on their own, and focusing more on the intrinsic qualities of sounds and what makes me like sounds and what makes me dislike sounds and what sounds I like to make and what kind of sounds I like to make with other people and so on.
I guess I'm curious, do you think that having those additional, I guess, skills, for lack of a better word, or a different knowledge base, do you think that leads you to a different place artistically that maybe if you hadn't had a higher level of study, you wouldn't have gotten to?
That's a really good question. I mean, I definitely think that in the very intense vocal training, ear training, and score study that I had to do in order to get my degree, my relationship with sound changed. The way that I use my ears changed, the way that I use my voice changed. And that's just because I was exposed to all of these different kinds of things. And so I know a lot more about how to describe sounds now. And I would say that that's a lot easier to describe in concrete ways. So I know about leading tones, and I know about voice leading, and I know about counterpoint, and all of those things that make the difference between like a block chord arrangement and like a really complex melodic arrangement, right? But I think it's somewhat impossible to say for sure whether or not it's changed the way that I create music. I would say that I personally would guarantee that my experience at Oberlin has changed the way I made music and changed the way that I interacted with my process. But I don't think I could even begin to describe how.
Do you record your own music, or do you work in studios, or is it a mixture of both?
Yeah. So I record all of my own music, because of the education that I got at Oberlin, and the very balanced study between like composition and recording engineering within my specific department. I was given lots of opportunities to work on my recording skills, as well as my mixing skills, my production skills. And those were all things that I was graded on, you know, throughout my education at Oberlin, and things that I took quite seriously. I don't think I'm like the world's best producer, but I work with a very stripped down setup. My home studio only consists of a few very specific tools, and is constantly sort of changing and fluctuating to meet the needs of my living arrangement. I would really love to have like a fancy home studio one day, but right now I'm really just doing the best with what I've got. And honestly, I would prefer that to paying someone else to make my music, because the production process, the mixing process, and even the mastering process, as bad at it as I am, it's all very intimate, and it's very special to me, and it's very fun to me.
Do you find it's difficult for you to release control of a project to someone else, like another outside producer or engineer?
You know, it's interesting to ask myself that question. I have never sent, well, I guess that's a little bit misleading. I've only collaborated with people on my music that I wrote maybe once before in my life. I sent over some stems from a track for my friend to produce it. And it was actually like some of the most fun that I've ever had in my life. Like, he took all of these crazy samples and instruments that I never would have thought to use, and changed the song. It was basically a different song. It was really fun. And I have no regrets, and I would be 100% down to do it again, but he didn't ask again, and nobody's asked me since. So I guess it just hasn't happened.
Well, when I was listening to your stuff earlier, I sort of got the impression that it might be home recording, and I'm a home recorder myself. And there's just something about it when, especially if you listen to it over headphones, which I do and did, that I just really enjoy and I really connected to, because I'm in a similar situation. I don't have a huge budget for an amount of gear, despite having this, you know, nice microphone here. but I don't have a whole lot else. And I really enjoyed listening to it, and it really kind of gave me a very particular sense of, like you said, intimacy, and it just seemed very personal.
Thank you so much. I would definitely say that my solo project, Hannah Sandoz, is the most personal artistic endeavor I've taken up. I have other side projects and stuff scattered across the internet, visual art practices and so on and so forth, other ways of expressing myself that feels slightly less intimate. But the idea of having my face so close to a microphone and so close to a computer screen and, you know, in the headphones for every step of the process, it takes a lot of self to create in this way.
Well, you've certainly had a lot of creativity lately, it seems. I know you put out a record in January, which I was just listening to, and then you have another one coming out August 15th. Where has all of that inspiration come from?
That's a really great question, actually. I planned out the year of Alone very, very meticulously. I would say that basically every detail of that album was intentional. Obviously, there are small things that I would have changed if I could, like little recording things, but it was very orchestrated. And then my release that I'm releasing in August, I've only been planning on releasing for a few months now. When I released The Year of Alone, I thought that I would be done for about a year. I thought that I would take the next year or so to write new songs and to plan out my next big project and to move forward. But there were a couple of things happening and a couple of transitions in my life coming up that gave me a sense of urgency and I guess sort of a feeling that I needed to put work into the world again. One of those transitions was graduating from Oberlin. I graduated with my degree in May. And then one of those transitions was also moving to Chicago right after I graduated. I packed up everything and brought myself and all my art supplies and instruments and plants to Illinois, where I'm settled in now. And I think that this sense of urgency and this sense of uncertainty really just motivated me to work on my art. I released an old song, actually, which is something I very rarely do. The second track on To Love and Loss, Over Stare, was actually demoed and released on a secret Bandcamp project a couple of years ago. And then I remembered the song, and I thought that it fit really well with not only the album, but kind of what I was trying to capture on this album. So like this sense of goodbyes and this sense of departure and this sense of being in limbo between one home and another. And so, yeah, I would say that I released this one out of necessity, out of spiritual necessity, more so than like a carefully planned like PR approach. But I'm really hoping that it can be valuable to someone in this very strange summer that we've all found ourselves in.
I was about to ask if the pandemic added some extra juice to that sense of urgency that you were just describing.
Definitely. I mean, I have never struggled with the idea of uncertainty and accepting uncertainty as much as I am right now until the COVID-19 pandemic started. I've always been an anxious person and I've always had an anxious attachment. But the pandemic really, I mean, I think traumatized everyone. You know, it took all of our understanding of what a life is and what the world is and kind of twisted that and distorted it. I wouldn't say it flipped it upside down because there's so much that's the same as it was before. But it really put everything through this kind of lens, this like foggy lens, right? Where we don't really know where we are, what's happening. And so urgency is a big thing with that. I kind of feel like I have to write all the music until like all the music before I'm gone or before the world explodes or something like that. Not to get too dark. I mean, I hope that I have lots of time to keep writing music, but, and then I think part of it was just that I wanted to have this document, of moving, you know, this tape, this release, whatever you call it, I wanted to have this little postcard to myself to look back on, to be like, oh, what was it like when I was graduating college and when I was moving to Chicago for the first time? And then I can listen to it and I can be like, ah, yeah, that's what it was like.
Time out. Before we get back to Hannah Sandoz, I have a few things I'd like to tell you about. The new Loose Opinions LP, Shadow of a Shadow, is out August 20th on Back to the Light Records. Graham Burks, the mastermind behind the project, will be on the show next week. For now, check out the single Yesterday Never Arrives on Bandcamp, Spotify, YouTube, or looseopinions.com. To celebrate the release, we have events coming up in Memphis. August 20th from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Memphis Listening Lab is the Back to the Light listening party and live conversation. Plus, later that night, I'm at the High Tone with Gloria Sabor. August 21st at DKDC is an early show to celebrate the Loose Opinions release. Doors at 7:30, starts at 8, with Jack Oblivion, Loose Opinions, and later on, Marcella Simeon. As always, to support me and the show, visit patreon.com/jdrieger. For updates on everything, check out backtothelight.net. And now, the ad. You've just heard At Least I Tried from the new EP To Love and Loss by my guest, Hannah Sandoz. Let's get back to our conversation. What brought you to Chicago?
I lived here 2 years ago. I got an internship at AudioTree as a recording engineer. I worked really closely with Rick Fritz, who is a friggin' genius. He is so, so good at what he does. And I'm actually in the AudioTree studios every now and then to this day. I kind of like hang out and watch him do what he does, try to help out where I can. And that is a blessing. I mean, every time I walk into that studio, I notice something new, I learn something new, I see something new happening. And that was really the first time I had been in a space other than Oberlin with that kind of like creative energy. I don't know how else to describe it, but there's this creative energy that hangs in that studio space. And even just to be there physically with those people, it like stirred something up inside me that was so exciting and so compelling and so alluring that I was like, okay, like after that summer, I was like, okay, when it's time to move, unless I have a place that I really, really like or a job I really, really need, I'm going to move to Chicago.
Do you find it, or are you having any trouble adjusting to Chicago? I know my first couple of years in Chicago when I moved up from Memphis were extremely difficult.
Definitely. It has been extremely difficult. The rent in, you know, in the city proper is much, much more than it was in rural Ohio. like a lot, more than twice as much. So that's been interesting. I actually, I did get a job before I came here. I had everything all lined up. I anticipated that I would be working full time at this job at least until the end of the year, if not indefinitely. But as you might expect, it did not work out. So I'm kind of in between odd jobs right now. I'm a server for a catering company, so I've been showing up to people's weddings and giving them hors d'oeuvres and cleaning up after their dinners and stuff. And I really like that. I like the people watching, and I like that it's a much more relaxed environment than what I had come here to occupy myself with as far as financial means goes. So financially, it's been pretty hard. Socially, it hasn't been the easiest. I am very lucky to have a little bit of a network here from Oberlin. There's this strange like phenomenon of people from Lafayette, Louisiana, specifically moving to Chicago. So I have a lot of my best friends from high school and a lot of my acquaintances from high school either living here right now, have lived here in the past, are about to move here and live here again. So yeah, I would say that the transition has been tough and that I'm always kind of like grinding to make ends meet, but it's not any different than when I was in college. I always had like a few jobs throughout college and a few side hustles and a few people that I knew and things that I needed to move and shake and do. So as far as my time management goes, it's been tough, but it's working out.
Well, it's cool that you have a support network kind of in place already. I would have killed to have had that when I moved here.
Yeah. I'm very fortunate. I also like moved in with these randos that I met on Facebook. I was like, does anyone want to be in a semi-communal like space for artists and musicians? And I found these three people online who were like, oh yeah, we were planning on doing that, but we lost a guy. Like, do you want to be our new guy? And I was like, yeah, I want to be your new guy, but like, hopefully you're not all crazy. And I moved in and now we're all really close and really like each other. And we got a drum set and we're like jamming all the time and going to jams together at like Archie's and places like that. And making music together and going to each other's gigs. So that's another thing that I'm really grateful for. My roommates, Kayla, Nicole, and Tanner have been so ridiculously supportive of me and my transition. And I like to think that I've been there for them and in their own, because all of us are new to the city, except for Nicole, who went to DePaul.
You said earlier that you were also interested in visual arts. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I actually drew and made like animated cartoons when I was in middle school and into high school a little bit. I don't know. I really enjoyed doing it. I thought I was pretty good at it. But I tried to get into talented art in high school. And that's kind of where things fell apart for me. I got rejected from talented art twice in a row. And being the dramatic 14-year-old I was, I swore off visual art forever. Tried out for talented music, and that's where I had my first musical mentor, and that's where I started composing and started writing songs. And that was really the first time in my life that anybody had really given me the confidence I needed to apply to a conservatory of music. And then in applying to the conservatory and going to Oberlin, I was introduced to the idea that there's no such thing as good art and bad art, that we just create. We just identify ourselves as artists and what we make is art. And it's neither good nor bad. It's just a document of our experience. And that's how I feel about my art, is it's just a document of my experience. And so that really inspired me and really uplifted me to start creating visual art again. And I would say that my art lies somewhere at the intersection between printmaking, collage, and sculpture. So it's either one of those things or a combination of all three when I make art. And I'm really grateful that I've fallen back into that practice, because the way that it's intersected with my musical practice has been really rewarding.
I think you kind of already answered this, but I'm going to ask anyway, because I was curious which, like, both academically and I guess sort of professionally out in the world, whether you found music or visual art to be the more difficult path to pursue.
If I had taken visual art seriously at any place other than the Lafayette public school system, I think it would be a little bit easier to answer. That being said, I was thinking about this earlier. I would argue that as a profession, as a career, it is harder to make it in the visual art world, because when you're contending with a piece of visual art, right? When you show someone a piece of visual art, it's so much harder to answer the question, is this good art or bad art, directly, right? So it's like so much more contingent on people's taste, in my opinion, visual art. So like if I show someone a piece of like art that I made, a painting, a 24 foot by 24 foot painting with like all of these beautiful abstract details that took like hours and hours and days and days, but it was like made up of pink and orange hues and they didn't like pink and orange hues, they'd be like, oh, I hate it. I hate it. I can't believe you spent weeks on this. Let's get it out of here, right? I feel like it's a lot more subjective, but at the same time, I think that, maybe I'm taking the pickiness of music snobs for granted. So I don't know. It's a tough question to answer.
I saw that you had a gig recently at a place called the Savemore here in Chicago.
My show went really well. Honestly, the sound guy, Pepe, was really, really sweet. I had a really great time talking to him, as well as the bartender, who I think was named Angela. Both of those people were awesome, awesome people to work with and to hang out with, both like before, during, after the show. The sound was pretty good. I think I sounded okay. It's really hard when like with ceilings that low and like as much reverb as I like to use, it can be a struggle. But it sounded good. The show was fun. Unfortunately, the tip jar bucket was not passed around, so that was the one sad thing about the night. But other than that, it was a great spot to gig at, and I would love to go back, because it was just a really cute, like, little lounge, free pool, free darts, good drinks. It's like, what else could you want?
Well, this has been really fun. I enjoyed meeting you on the computer and having this talk. Would you like to refer people to Bandcamp page, social media pages, stuff like that?
Yeah, this has been really awesome. I'm having such a great time talking to you, JD. This is my first time like being an interview subject, so I hope it's gone relatively smoothly on your end. I've edited interview audio, and I know how tough that can be, so good luck. I will say that thank you. My Instagram is Snaods, or SNAODZ. My Bandcamp is Hannah Sandoz, HANNAHSANDOZ. .bandcamp.com. And I'm also available on Spotify as Hannah Sandoz. So those are my socials.
Your new thing is coming out on cassette. I actually thought of something else I wanted to ask you. What has your experience been releasing stuff on cassette? Because I also run a little label on the side, and I've considered doing cassettes myself. So do you think that they've been selling well for you, I guess?
Yeah, so The Year of Valone had a very, very limited run of 20 cassettes, and my intention with that run was to sell out. I did indeed sell out, and I did indeed make a small profit from that record. I was overjoyed. I mean, I was ridiculously proud, because when I first started making music when I was 15, I would every now and then get my computer and my phone taken away for good reason. I had very reasonable parents. But every now and then I would find myself without a way of recording music with my voice memos app or GarageBand or so on. So I had a cassette deck, and I started collecting cassettes and I started recording cassettes. Anytime I would write a song or make up a little thing that I wanted to finish later, I would record it on a cassette tape. And I would keep these cassette tapes as like archives of everything I'd done. And I eventually digitized them and released them as a series of demos on one of my old side projects from high school, one of those old band camps. And then after that, I finally put together like a quote unquote full length release. And I was so proud of it. It was just a few tracks that I put together in GarageBand that had been kind of refined from the big cassette release that I did right before that in digitizing, like, I guess, my archives. But I was so, so, so proud of it. And I didn't have anywhere near the means to make merch. So I actually got some cassettes from Goodwill and I like duped them all myself. And it was super painstaking because all I had was like one cassette deck with a single deck and like a headphone jack and like an aux cord and my computer. So I duped them myself and I made some like limited edition, like custom cover art, and I dropped them in the free bin at my local record store. And like, as laborious and like not fiscally rewarding as that was, it just felt like a love letter to the universe, because like I had gotten this really intimate relationship with cassettes, and I really, really cherish them and love them. I was just so happy to put them out into the world and to make more of them. I've always found them strangely at the intersection of looking and feeling like toys, but operating as art objects. And that duplicity, I guess duplicity is a bad word, that duality that, that cassettes have between being an art object and being a toy is something that I've always found really joyous and just really attractive. So I would definitely recommend putting out basically anything on cassette ever, because they're wonderful and I love them.
Do you think that's going to be your primary medium moving forward, or do you see yourself expanding to vinyl or CDs at some point?
That's a great question. I like really daydream about someday being signed with a small label who like wants me to put out a vinyl record. And if somebody wanted me to put out a vinyl record, I would be overjoyed, because I think vinyl is just so nifty and so gorgeous and very similar to cassettes, if not quite a lot more breakable, right? But it's just one of those things where cassettes are very cheap and easy to make and have that good analog throwback that I just find to be really unique and charming. I actually have made CDs before. They didn't sell very well. And at the same time, I was still in high school. So it was like my practice and my sphere was very limited to like this one record store that I would go to in high school, and like also all my friends and also all my friends' moms. So the CD release didn't go very well. I was like haunted by like extra copies of these CDs hanging around my car, my bedroom, like my storage bins for like several years before I eventually took them and like threw them all in a free bin somewhere in Oberlin and just got rid of them. But cassettes, they feel a lot more intimate. And for that reason, I'm going to keep my runs very small until demand has far outgrown them.
Well, again, this was fun. Thanks so much for taking some time to talk to me, and hopefully we'll cross paths in Chicago sometime soon.
Yeah, this was so much fun. Thank you so much for taking out the time and for having interest in my work and for crafting all of these wonderfully worded and very thoughtful interview questions. I had a really great time talking to you, JD. Let's keep in touch. I want to check out your project. I want to talk about booking something at Savemore. Let's keep in touch, man. It's been really nice.
Awesome. You're too kind. Thank you.
Thank you. Have an awesome afternoon. Take care.
To close the show, let's hear another song from Hannah's new EP, To Love and Loss. This is Overstare. That's the show. Thank you to Hannah Sandoz. Thank you to Arthur with two H's for the opening theme. Thank you to Joey Pegram for the closing theme. Thank you for listening. For music, news, and episode archives, visit backtothelight.net. And until next week, take care, y'all. Part of the Back to the Light podcast network at backtothelight.net.